Working together we can make a change. Working together we can help better things.
Restoring the Soul, Faith and Community Partnerships. This organization is dedicated to developing Boulder County social capital through education, communication, and collaboration. Our main educational activity consists of monthly forums on crucial social issues viewed through a local lens. The panelists are Boulder County experts in the topic field. For more information, please go to our website, www.restoringthesoul.org.
Welcome to the Restoring the Soul and Collaborative Community Forum called Baby Boomers Are Revisioning the Potential of Our Elder Years. Today is the inaugural broadcast from The Hub in downtown Boulder. Thank you to The Hub for sponsoring this event today. Also, thank our sponsors, Windhorse Family and Elder Care, windhorsecare.com, and Project Revive, projectrevive.com. So we have a panel that is comprised of professionals who have been working with in the senior population for many decades. And they're here to tell you about recent major changes that they're witnessing. What's happening is that the boomer generation is helping to transform our culture's perception of how one's elder years can be lived and how we can relate to end-of-life issues as a community. I'm Prescott Nock, MA, Central Committee member of the Contemplative End of Life Project, CEOLP, and we pronounce this KELP, co-founder of the Buddhist Coalition, and an organizer of community projects for seniors such as Aging Well in Lyons, Community Connections and Resources. I'll be followed by Kathy Emery, MA, LPC. She's a contemplative psychotherapist in the Windhorse model for over 30 years and former Naropa University faculty for many different psych departments. Judith Oakland, MA, LPC, CHP, is a contemplative psychotherapist for 22 years and a former geriatric therapist for Mental Health Partners, and is a specialist in working trauma through the body. Jody Sharp, MA, is co-founder and director of Windhorse Family and Elder Care, and is a former chaplain of Boulder Community Hospital, and a specialist in grief and loss psychotherapy and end-of-life care. So why is it important that we talk about baby boomers and what are they creating? For perspective, the number of people in the U.S. over age 65 is projected to double by 2030. In contrast, the number of people in Colorado over the age of 65 is projected to nearly triple by 2030. Which county in Colorado do you think they're the most baby boomers? So, you know, really, look around you. This is, Boulder County is a central hub of baby boomers in the nation, actually. Once again, helping our society to re-envision what our full potential can be through every aspect of our life, even living fully through our process of death. Overwhelmingly, boomers want to do what is called aging in place, which is continuing to live in their homes. AARP conducted a Colorado study and asked if people agreed to the following statement: what I'd really like to do is remain in my current residence as long as possible. So of the ages 50 to 64, 85% strongly agreed. 65 and over, 88% strongly agreed. This is it's a revolution in how our communities are to be structured. Something to really think about. You know, boomers don't want to be put in artificial corporate retirement centers. They want to co-create their own communities and care for one another and deepen the idea of what care for one another can be. It's less bingo and more meaningful group activities that are co-created with friends, shared with friends. And the quality of caregiving is being reevaluated as well, with more interest in contemplative caregiving. We'll be speaking about that in depth. And really, past generations may have accepted task-oriented care, but boomers are asking for more holistic and deeper care that addresses physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual needs. Contemplative care emphasizes the quality of relationship, which is deepened by increasing awareness between caregiver and client. Contemplative care approaches even the most basic tasks as opportunities to develop a greater awareness to foster deeper relationships. So many of us working in the realm of senior services have noticed an explosion of courses, discussion groups, forums, all dealing with end-of-life issues, discussing everything from the most practical legal matters to the most sensitive subjects of grief and loss, which is important to have a network for. And really, you know, open discussions about these topics really helps to dispel fear, and one can then move beyond misconceptions and live more fully in the present moment. You know, adequate time given, especially in a group setting. There's a 1 year to live class, working with sickness, old age, and death, conversations on death, aging and saging, the conversation project, conscious dying, befriending small deaths and big deaths, the grief support networks discussions. A lot of these classes we have heard lately were anticipated to have a dozen to maybe two dozen people, and then 80 people showed up. And this has happened with a few classes. So there's just real interest in this. And it's also showing change in the culture to just have more courage to discuss these topics. Windhorse Family and Elder Care is going to be sponsoring a course. It's called the Death Cafe. A phenomenon that started in Europe, started in Switzerland, then went to France and England, and now it's coming across the pond over here. Basically, it's an open forum to talk about death, frankly. Many of these other courses that I just mentioned are also addressing these topics, but this will be an ongoing class. It's an ongoing cafe to discuss these topics. So that will be happening in the fall, and you can find more information about that on the website as well, in addition to windhorsecare.com website. Many of the pioneers that are putting on these courses are also working together on a new grassroots initiative called the Contemplative End of Life Project that I mentioned earlier. KELP is bringing together local leaders in the fields of healthcare, spirituality, psychology, in-home care, education, and hospice care. And this is to co-create a new cultural relationship toward the potential of our elder years. It's just an opportunity to bring together resources to form a central information hub that is in a less formal atmosphere than some of the county agencies and can be more of a co-creative endeavor. So these pioneers are working together to create the ultimate hospice environment, which will offer much more than the typical Medicare model. The Contemplative Care Hospice is based in contemplative care and will support the spiritual traditions of each individual. The mission of KELP is honoring the sacredness of living, dying, and grieving. We offer compassionate end-of-life care and education rooted in contemplative practice. And then at the heart of the Contemplative End of Life Project is the Contemplative Care Hospice. This is really the central heart of the KELP project. The aim of the Contemplative Care Hospice is to create a freestanding, in-home, Medicare-certified hospice that is rooted in the contemplative care model. The hospice will serve Boulder and the surrounding communities regardless of ability to pay, and will serve as a model of contemplative end-of-life care that can be duplicated in other communities across the country. A number of spiritual leaders are supporting the vision of this project to help our community re-envision the spiritual potential of our elder years. The Contemplative End-of-Life Project is putting on our first large KELP forum that is happening Sunday, July 14th, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., and that'll be happening at Congregation Har Hashem, which is on Baseline in Boulder. We're very excited about this project, and we're honored to have as our keynote speaker Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, also known as Reb Zalman, and he'll be speaking about his lifelong pursuit of his aging and saging work, and also how he's supporting the KELP project. Also honored to have the Threshold Choir that will be performing. And the Threshold Choir specifically performs for people that are on in threshold situations in their life, so those that are in illness or those that are passing away. So there'll be more information about all this on our website, and we're looking for people that are interested in this, that want to join this initiative, looking for volunteers. Please contact us if you're interested in any of these topics. And for more info, you can contact us at windhorsecare.com. And now we'll continue with Kathy Emery.
Maybe to begin by saying a little more about my background in contemplative service and work with all ages, actually. I've been working in the Windhorse model for about 30-plus years and had the good fortune to be a part of the founding group in the early 80s. And this was a group of us graduates from Naropa University at that time in the psychology program. And we, along with Ed Podval, created this form, this approach to working with others. And initially it was mostly for major mental illness, you know, for folks having those kind of challenges and struggles. But since then and to this day, it has expanded and been applied to any age group, you know, including any kind of condition that a person might be challenged with, life transition, psychological, emotional challenges, aging, end of life, you know, as Prescott was talking about. So I have a real strong commitment to this approach and to this whole view, and I want to say a little bit about the philosophy and the view of it. So basically, some of the principles were drawn from a psychology symposium that took place in 1979 at Naropa. It's the founder of Naropa, Trungpa Rinpoche, a Tibetan teacher, artist, scholar, spoke about creating an environment of sanity. And this particular talk has been, you can read this, you know, in some of the contemplative literature. It's really kind of a root text in terms of the principles that inform this contemplative approach to working with others. And these three principles are that human beings are intrinsically healthy and sane and basically good. And the second is humans are inseparable. We are inseparable from our environments, which is the social environment and the physical environment, and that healing is possible no matter what your condition, my condition, that it's possible to have a healing experience. And just to say a little more about healing as opposed to curing, Judy Leaf, who is a great teacher and author of Making Friends, a book entitled titled Making Friends with Death, gave this wonderful talk at the Garrison Institute last December, I think it was, about the healing encounter. And in it, she makes a real distinction, or she points to the difference between being cured and being healed, that one could actually be cured but not healed, or healed but not cured. So in essence, what that means is that on any of these threshold experiences, you can be healed. You can have an ability to be with whatever's happening that assists you at that time. So basically, these principles shape the contemplative approach, and viewing individuals as whole, as interconnected with others in their world, thriving in a supportive social mandala with this view. Those are kind of the pillars of it. Another aspect of this environment that's created is that it's non-aggressive. So, and this is where the whole notion of contemplative practices really comes in, is how do we help to create and cultivate an environment that's non-aggressive. Contemplative practices, you know, have that as their root. And contemplative practices, including, you know, mindfulness awareness practice or Tai Chi, yoga, centering prayer, all of these disciplines working with how to integrate body and mind in the moment, you know, so we can, in essence, become more attuned and develop a better relationship with ourselves, which helps us relax and then can radiate out into our community, you know, with others and into the world. So befriending ourselves first is a fundamental piece of this experience, and then we're able to expand that. And also different qualities and Prescott talked about, you know, the benefits or the fruits of contemplative practice, but one can also cultivate more of a sense of openness and curiosity for your world, you know, yourself beginning as I mentioned, but then radiating out. Rather than being as reactive in a situation, you can actually take your time, you can slow down and respond instead of react. And also, as Prescott mentioned, and in the contemplative competencies class, which is happening right now, actually, at the Shambhala Center, one of the presenters, Kim Mooney, shared that she felt that the baby boomers were very instrumental in bringing sexuality and sexual issues out of the closet during the 60s. And so that same energy, that same curiosity, that same going toward instead of trying to ignore or push away is being enlisted, you know, is being manifest in this in these movements to really face aging and dying and death in a more open way, a more creative way. So when we talk about contemplative caregiving, or as we just recently were describing it as care partnering, this is more of a sense of giving and receiving. So this is how this approach translates into this work with elders and with the dying. That this openness to this relationship is not just focused on completing a task, coming into a caregiving situation and just knowing what you have to complete, but coming into this situation with a sense of openness and curiosity and actually attuning to what is happening in that moment. What is this person really needing on other levels? You know, so not pushing through, it's time for the bath, whatever, you know, might be the task that one has to attend to at some point, but just more of this willingness to step into that moment of this encounter with this person, and it's which is ultimately about human connectedness. It's being willing to feel your own humanity in the moment and being open to responding to the person that you're with as a full human being and seeing them as whole. So this whole notion of social mandala and this interconnectedness is very key in our work that are actually taking the form of cultural change movements, which have the intention of addressing the whole human being, the needs of the whole person. So some of these on a national level include the Aging in Place that Prescott mentioned, but also Eden alternative movements, which have been going on for a while. And these are mostly focused on deinstitutionalizing environments like nursing homes and other facilities. I love how they describe that what's very important for them is that people have close continuing contact with plants, animals, and children. So it's like really including all those connected aspects of one's life. And it's elder-centered as well. It's an elder-centered view, honoring the elder. Village movements are popping up around the country. The one of the earliest ones happened in the 1990s in Boston. It's called Boston Beacon Hill Village. Apparently there are 60 of these happening right now, but there are 600 in the planning stage. This is also described as good old-fashioned community, you know, people networking, coming together, consolidating services available in the community and supporting each other in this. And their intentions are to support each other with friendship and also to help with loneliness and isolation, you know, which is something that we all know can happen as we age. And of course, co-housing options have been going on since the 60s, and often these include multi-generational living situations, and some are senior focused, so we have some that are in particular for seniors. And then on a personal or individual level, baby boomers have been working with contemplative practice for a very long time. There's a huge percentage of baby boomers who have been involved with many practices, and this will impact their aging years, my aging years. You know. And also, there are many opportunities for elders to begin such practices. It's very common to have Tai Chi offered in nursing homes. And just as an example of some of the benefits of Tai Chi for elders is that it aids in balance. You know, it really helps because we all know that falling is a real risk as we age. So this is very, very beneficial. There are many other benefits, you know, relieving physical effects of stress, reducing blood pressure, accumulating energy, you know, from the practice. Presently, there are like volumes of scientific research and studies that have been conducted now for 20 plus years. They clearly show the benefits of contemplative practice on one's physical, psychological, emotional, social health, and well-being. I'd like to mention a few resources that will be notated further on. Like there's the Mind and Life Institute, which was founded in 1990 by Francisco Varela, neuroscientist, and Adam Engler. And since then, they've been conducting these seminars and conferences with prominent scientists who are also contemplatives, and then having these discussions with the Dalai Lama, and there are many books, there are about like 7 or 8 books that have been published from these dialogues, and they're very informative. They're about anything you can imagine, working with emotions. One is entitled Sleeping, Dreaming, and Dying, so bringing together this East-West view in terms of these topics. Another is there's a man named Richie Davidson, who's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin. He conducts an affective neuroscience lab, and he's the person who's been studying the brains of longtime practitioners. So some of these, in particular, Matthew Ricard, who's been practicing for 30-plus years. But anyway, there's a lot of evidence base for those of us who need that kind of validation. You know, there's a tremendous amount that's being published. And also, just to name Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's a very familiar person, who developed the mindfulness-based stress reduction approach and has worked a lot with pain, you know, using mindfulness in terms of pain and folks working with chronic pain. And he was at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up, but also to say that in terms of contemplative caregiving, there are studies that have been done, and I will have those available for Prescott to include, that give validity again to what the experience is from the receiving end of it for our clients and our folks that we work with. It's a real experience to be attended to by a person who has this contemplative orientation. And another quote from Judy Leaf, who does quite a bit of teaching on contemplative care, and she says that clients feel seen as people apart from their medical or mental problems. Mindful caregivers are able to listen more, talk less, and utilize more sophisticated understanding of nonverbal communication.
Thank you, Kathy.
You are listening to Restoring the Soul on KGNU Boulder, Denver. Today's topic is Baby Boomers Are Revisioning the Promise of Our Elder Years. Now back to our program.
And now I'll hear from Judith Oakland.
What I was thinking about as Kathy was talking too is that some of the isolation that I feel I've experienced, I'm in my 60s now, and you know, even though as boomers we did it and are doing it differently than the generation before us, we still, in our culture, we are worker bees. We really stay busy. And I think we brought a lot of connectivity with that busyness, and we've learned and kept how to gather in ways that I observed working on the geriatric team for Boulder County Mental Health Partners for many years. The generation ahead of us, our parents, didn't always do. They kind of worked hard and then retired and kind of got a bit more isolated, or, you know, had spent a lot of time building, you know, post-World War II, building their own resources and the resources for their children, who are many of us. And some of that social fabric didn't really re-enter. And you know, what some also is being researched now is that 60s, mid-50s through the 90s, and I mean chronological years, are seen as now a second adulthood. You know, and before it used to be, well, you did your working years, right, and worked hard and hopefully kept a family, friends, community somewhat intact, but many people didn't. And especially when, you know, working with elders, I see a lot of that. People who are the generation above me, who are in their maybe 80s or 90s now. A lot of that connectivity, if it wasn't with their family or their children died or were living far away, they really were more isolated. And the second adulthood, what we're discovering now is that it's a whole developmental stage. It's not like, well, you're older now and you go lateral, but you're older now and you have all this opportunity to keep developing and to keep growing and find parts of yourself that you didn't maybe have time to even know you were there. Our culture is really starting to appreciate, because of, I think, the bulge of the boomers and our needs and our wants and our ability to be more self-aware and have that opportunity, that we're going to keep growing. The quality of warehousing, like Kathy talked about the Eden Project. Well, I have an elder in the community where I live, and she needed, finally, we couldn't as a community have enough social resource to support her. It was like a Beacon Hill project, but she actually needed more, and we needed to go to a facility, but the facility was an Eden, so she could have pancakes at 2 in the afternoon if she wanted them. You know, and it wasn't people getting up and being regulated or, as we say from a contemplative view, having an agenda rather than having a view. Holding a view, they need to have good food. Holding an agenda, you have to eat now. this is staff-based, it's going to save our staff lots of time and save the company money, rather than actually person-based, as Kathy described. You know, that we're going to try to support that elder and those elders who are us to continue to grow and develop what is humanly, you know, our potential. And that keeps growing. Our awareness of the second adulthood has really shifted how we view age. And plus, you know, it's like there's the young old and there's the old old. And I think even if we sit here in this room and feel ourselves, you know, and whether you're in your 40s or your 80s, you could be young old or old old. That is not chronological, you know, because you can be, you know, running up Mount Sanitas at 85. Or at 50, you could feel like, you know, I can't get out of my chair. My life has kind of already happened. So that encouragement to help us, you know, have the vitality. Kathy talked about some of the contemplative practices that are really spreading, and because they work, and because also there's an interest in them. Because we've gotten so self-reliant, and it's a very strong element in our culture to be self-reliant, and that sometimes we can be overly self-reliant. And as we age, how to identify elders in our community that may need more help than they're getting, because sort of stiff upper lip, or, you know, if they're in a place where they can do it by rote, or we can kind of feel our way. Often if they have to move and go live in a different kind of community, you actually see that they really aren't able to be very self-reliant. They've just kind of been able to do it through memory or habitual pattern. So what I'd like to do is just focus a little bit on our community here and give you some ways that you can help in the community nurture bringing our elders more into an integrated or a whole sense of their own lives, and also how we benefit by looking out after them. So if you have older adults in your life, older than you, parents, friends, family, community members. Often we live in communities, thank goodness, that aren't too segregated, that we have mixed ages. But a need for help, I'm just going to give you seven kind of broad categories that somebody in your life, in your connectional network, may be needing some help. And then what I'd like to do is give you some resources that will also be on the website, but there'll be names that you can contact and how to resource to be able to help yourself as an elder, like me, or other elders in your life. So the seven areas that you could look out for in the community, and this could be riding the bus. The first one is the mental state of an older person. If you're with someone or family member and you notice that they're more confused, they're tending to be a little more repetitive or exhibiting some memory loss, some cognitive deficit, that their mental state, this is a sign, you know, that kind of needs to be flagged. Just, okay, let me attune to this. Let me pay some attention. This person's mental state, I think she's told me this story two or three times now. And I've been her neighbor for 10 years and she never did that. Just to attune to that. The second aspect, of course, is physical, that you start to see a difference. And this is us, in your seeing, your hearing, your walking, or you notice an increase in substance abuse. You also notice, and you might not look for signs of their appearance, or you notice that you could care less whether you had lunch or changed your sweater in a week or two. There's also the emotional signals that indicate that there is some need for the community in one way or another, those of us, to come in a little closer and start to get curious. Around the emotional, especially a loss of a partner, a loss of work, seeing somebody who's more emotionally withdrawn than you have known them, loss of appetite, their mood starts to shift, they're grumpier, you feel grouchier. This is also signs for us to get help, right? You see more isolation. Again, you notice that a family member or somebody in the community is just not coming to their local, volunteering at the nursing home, or they're volunteering at the library, or getting out and walking and have their walking poles with them. You notice that there's a real difference in weight loss. And also, if they are living in their own home, we are, you know, that you see that the home is declining, or you see that the pets aren't really being taken care of. And this pet was a constant companion and a very, very welcome and cherished part of the family, but somehow there's neglect. Also, the last indicator that you might notice around elders needing help is that they're getting confused about economics, about money. They're not able to track much of those things, and or they're unable to afford the kind of help and care and support that it looks like they might be needing. These tangible things, because we are such a self-reliant culture, it might not always be easy to approach somebody. And so I think some of the principles that Kathy talked about, and Jody is after me going to kind of spin a yarn here and share a little more of her personal experience of how that's happened, that, you know, for the most part, I would say lean in and check in with whomever you see in your world that may be exhibiting some of these indicators. You know, just how are you? You know, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's great aunt, how are you doing? How are you feeling? What's interesting? Share a little bit of yourself as well and see if you can make, you know, a connection with them. There are resource specialists here at the Senior Center. Boulder is an amazingly resourced community. I happened to be part of, in the early days, which were the late 80s, there's a mental health center peer counseling program, which trains those of us over 60 to go out and be therapeutic with other elders in the community, free of charge. And the community, you know, you do a 10-week training program, and you it's all volunteer. And once a week, all of the people who are peer counselors, who trained as peer counselors, come together and share their experiences. So they have their own group of what was it like to go in and talk with somebody who was had been so isolated and so irritable that basically the neighborhood had completely abandoned them, and including maybe their family. But they had agreed to having somebody their own age, who they didn't have to pay money to, come in and talk with them. You know, what was that like? And so those group of peer counselors get their support group to be able to work with people who are in transition or in difficult situations and really be able to sit with their pain. You know, not try to fix it, not try to cure it, but often, as we know, so much of the healing happens in just being able to be with, you know, and not run away and not try to fix it. So that program will also be accessed through the website if you're interested. It's the Senior Peer Counseling Program for Boulder County, and it's in Longmont as well. And, of course, Mental Health Partners, the older adult team, it has been just a wealth of community inspiration and help. And many of its services, most of its services, are covered through Medicare. So it's also a place that you can contact if you need psychological services. They also have this wonderful program that they call Senior Reach. It's funded through the city and county and state, and actually has some federal funding too. But they offer support to, say, you have an older person that you know of that you think may need some help, or it can be a neighbor you can call. Like, if you don't know how to approach this person, and it could be a person in your family, it could be a person in your neighborhood, and you don't really know, but you think there's some trouble there or there's some concern, you can contact somebody at Senior Reach. And what they do is they contact the person. Often right now, a lot of the referrals are coming through clergy, are coming through community activities where they see somebody just isn't showing up in the same way that they used to, with the same kind of vibrancy. So they can call Senior Reach and say, I'm concerned about somebody, and give the name. And of course, what they have done is they've asked this person, would you like to be contacted? And then they will be contacted by somebody from Senior Reach and say, would you like some support? Can I come out? And it could be, could I come out and clean out your refrigerator? Could I come out and just see what you might need that would help you live your life in a more full way? And as Kathy talked about, aging in place, to be able to support you to be as independent and live exactly how you darn well please, which seems to be a very strong passion in our particular culture. Thank goodness, because I trust our wisdom. And especially as we age, I trust it. It doesn't mean just because you're older, you're going to be wiser. But you know, the odds are good. The odds are really good. The local senior center is always going to be a resource for you to just call and ask for the resource person. And they have lists and resources from everything from very tangible kinds of services to facilities. You know, you have an elder that might want to literally be in a different living environment. Well, what are the options and what are the costs? And they literally can sit down with you and just kind of work it through with you and look at all the options. So it's in one place. And granted, we're all getting good, right, looking on the web. But they have amazing resources, and there's a human being connected to those resources, which I still think we can't do without. The last thing I wanted to offer is, if you have some people in your life that our family members tend to do this more. Why can family members push our buttons sometimes more than anybody else in our world? You know, how does that work? I think it's because they got in under the radar, right? They're in, they're close, they're under our defenses, they're under our ability to keep them at a distance, you know. What they say, how they treat us, has such an impact. And I'd like to just leave you with a few tips. If you have any of this kind of behavior in your life, you have someone, it doesn't have to be an elder, who is kind of driving you a little crazy, and you don't know why, you hear the phone ring or they text you and say, can you come over? You know, the lights aren't working in the hallway. And maybe they've asked you this question already 3 times that week. Could you just come over and the lights aren't working? And you know it's really not about the lights aren't working. And that's part of what's irritating you, that there's some behaviors that really aren't addressing. That's not really what the need is. So what I'm going to ask you to pay attention to, if there are behaviors like this that are causing you to be irritated and maybe causing you to distance from these people in your life and not want to go in and be present with them. If you have a contemplative practice, of course, this helps you a lot because you can kind of just, you know, hold your own heart and mind and presence and actually receive what's happening in the environment. You've had some training in that. But there are usually goals, and if somebody's calling you and asking you the same question over and over to come, you know, might ask yourself, so what's the goal of this behavior? Is it attention or love? Is it power or control? Are they just trying to manage my business? Or is it actually retaliation, or, you know, they're hurting and to actually hurt you? And this is the least present that I see in this kind of behavior in the people that I've worked with, that it's about sort of revenge or hurting back. But sometimes it just is. And if you can kind of identify the behavior, identify maybe they just want the attention and they're feeling lonely, or they're not sure you love them. Now that you have a new partner in your life, you're not spending every Thursday night dinner with them, and they may call you more or ask for more. And if you can identify the goal that is, you know, really they want to know that they're still loved or they're still included or they still are part of your bandwidth of attention. If you can name that goal, it will go a huge way. You know, for instance, you know, mom, you know, we worked on the light bulbs. I think they're all working in the hallway, but I do want you to know I really care about you. And I know you moved into this new facility and it's a little strange and you don't have your way around, but you know, I love that you're still 5 miles away from me and that we can still talk. And I'm so glad you're still here on the planet. What you're actually addressing, and often what you'll see, is the true need for that maybe irritating behavior. And you're actually connecting in a way that you're going to also see that behavior truly lessen, because the actual goal of that behavior has been met. I had one person I worked with, and he would just not want to work. You know, he just wouldn't take his medications, which really kept his blood pressure and his blood sugar stable. He just wouldn't. And when we realized part of it was what he really needed, it wasn't that he was just a grumpy guy, you know, and kind of being obstreperous and oppositional. He needed to have some power and some control over his life. That was really the goal. And so when some of the care partners started to say to him, you know, George, you're in charge here. You're in charge. You're the boss. And when you're the boss, we all work better. So right now, you're the boss of this morning. We got a couple things to do. Which one do you want to choose first? Because you're the boss. And it would automatically bring a smile to his face. And the relationship that could develop from him and the people that were working with him really blossomed. And they started to like George better, which, of course, George is having a better life.
Thanks, Judith. Wow, thanks for, you know, helping to bring our awareness to those aspects, family and in the community. Now we'll hear from Jody Sharp.
The fundamental principles that Kathy spoke of earlier, and then the very practical things that Judith spoke about, they play out in all of our work at Windhorse, but it's actually my honor today to tell a tale about a woman that we worked with named Renee. Before I begin, I want to repeat those principles because they're truly at the essence of her life story. So the principles are that human beings are intrinsically healthy and sane. We are inseparable from our physical and social environments. Healing is possible for everyone, no matter the circumstances. Whenever I think of these principles, I think of Renee. And I think of how important it was that the key ingredient in creating a healthy environment was to create a relationship with her and a connection. As we age, we all deal with loss after loss of every kind. But when illness and suffering are surrounded by human kindness and affection, We can confront our challenges and fears and even our own mortality with courage. We can begin to forgive ourselves and others, to lighten up on our mistakes and shortcomings and fears, to relax and even begin to have humor. Years of tightness and rigidity and holding on to unresolved conflicts and unfinished business can melt away. The stories we've created and held on to so dearly our entire lives can soften and change. So I'm going to talk about Renee, a woman we worked with for almost a decade. Renee was born into aristocracy in the late 20s and lived to be 83. She was one of four siblings, and at the age of 4 or 5, lost both her parents to tuberculosis. All four children were adopted out, a brother and sister to one family, and Renee and a sister to another. She was cared for primarily by nannies, but none of them lasted long because she was so intolerable. Her home and her life were broken, and she responded by acting out in rageful tirades and even cruelty at times. She was diagnosed as bipolar as a young girl and frequently placed in psychiatric hospitals beginning at age 7 and into her teens. In these institutions, all kinds of horrors were played out. She was eventually prescribed lithium, which tamped down her darkest fears and created some stability, but also tamped down her aliveness and her passion. As a young woman, she moved to Boulder and never returned to her home, even though throughout her life it was a longing to return. She made a few friends and quasi-adopted a family here in Boulder, becoming like a caring aunt to the children. She never married or had children of her own and was never able to hold down a job. Throughout her adult life, she was kept at a distance by her siblings, who well remembered her years of acting out. Her family tolerated her but didn't trust her and didn't have much affection for her. She was never really part of a whole except from a painful distance. Life moved along and she got by as an adult with the help of lithium, but was periodically hospitalized for psychosis when she'd go off medication, which was fairly frequent. Not long before we met, the lithium had become toxic to her liver, so she could no longer tolerate it. I first met Renee when she was in a locked facility wearing an ankle bracelet and full of psychotic fear. She was leery of me at first, concerned that the airplanes flying overhead were monitoring her, and she was trying to work out whether or not I had anything to do with that. I somehow managed to allay her fears and passed her test. Once she was stabilized on medication and home again, she began to appear to us more fully. She was quirky and unconventional, a renegade and a tomboy, and somewhat wild, at times like a wildfire burning out of control. The team that worked with her tentatively and with great care began to create an environment of containment and protection and shelter for her rageful fire. Over the next 9.5 years, we went on walks with her, we shared meals with her, we shopped for groceries, went to doctor's appointments, and on nearly every visit, we played Scrabble. Renee's version of Scrabble, of course, which was basically that the first one to run out of tile wins, and anything goes in between. She was highly intelligent, but in Scrabble, often made up words, and would look up glaring, daring us to challenge her, which we mostly did. And she would reluctantly pick up the tiles and play a real word when she was challenged, but she never tired of trying to get away with it. You could always tell what kind of mood she was in by the words she played, most of which, or at least some of which, can't be repeated on the air. One of our adventures into stores and shops around Boulder, we came upon a photo of Lincoln. She started to pass it by, but instead stopped and looked at it for a very long time. And then finally she turned to me and said, "He suffered from mental illness too." That seemed to mark a beginning of a real softening about her life. She developed humor about her mental illness and at times would have us rolling with laughter. There are a few other stories I probably shouldn't share on the air here. With all that time together, the relationships became more and more authentic and real, and Renee began to relax and let us in. There's no better example of this than in the way her greeting changed over the years. In the beginning, she would open the door of her home with a look of almost, "I dare you to enter." And we would stand there and stare at one another for a while. And then she would slowly and reluctantly step aside and let us pass by. Her body was so rigid, it looked as though it might break. And she would keep us at a safe distance. But over time, Renee began to soften, and the greeting became more like a song. She'd open the door and sing out our names. Jody! She began to let us touch her hand or back, or even begin reaching out for us as she stepped off curbs and walked up steps. In the last years of her life, she would open the door, fling her arms as wide apart as possible, and wait for a hug and kiss. Sometimes we'd have things in our hands, if it was winter especially, and we'd need to put them down first, so she would just stand there patiently with her arms open wide. In essence, over time, we became Renee's family. It took a lot of time, sharing ordinary life activities and a lot of hard work to recreate what had been broken. It's not that she wasn't lovable or had never loved herself, but for most of her life, affection just really hadn't been returned. A few days before her death, whenever one of us went into the room, she would sing out our names and open her arms as usual for that hug and kiss. But now she added the words, "I'm dying. I'm dying." She didn't say it in a fearful way. She was just proclaiming that a big event was about to happen and she wanted us to know. I would hug her back and say, "I know, Renee. I know you're dying." And she did. But not before she blessed each of us. Against all the odds of her life, Renee was surrounded by people who truly loved her in the end. And in the end, we were also able to build a bridge to her family. Instead of merely tolerating her from a distance, they began to feel fondness and affection again. They would call, and they called her by her nickname, Ren, which they hadn't used since they were all children together. It's these loving relationships which can create the ability to repair. For Renee, they allowed her to create meaning at the end of her life and to let go with kindness and acceptance. This story of Renee has been an example of one end of the spectrum of suffering. There are so many more. But the dynamics play out in each of us in our lives and in our family systems. We are basically all intrinsically healthy and well, and all in need of tenderness and affection from our human family. This can sometimes be challenging, as Judith talked about the buttons families can push. There's a lifetime of roles and history and embedded reactions to each other. But when these elements are present, they can create healing and relaxation into end of life and death.
Wow, thank you very much, Jody, for that story. It's just a great example of you know, how we can create community, even when we may not be born with the community around us, make connections in many different ways, as we've all been talking about today. We can now take questions from the audience. All the information available online, both on the Restoring the Soul website and the windhorsecare.com website, for all the references of information that we've cited, as well as books and organizations and website references, so you can find all that later.
You know, elders quite often find themselves with a condition or find themselves in a situation that maybe they haven't experienced before. They don't want to talk about it. It needs to be talked about, but they may be avoiding for whatever reason. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how to approach an elder when you see that. How do you approach that person in a way that doesn't just promote more avoidance?
One of the first rules I use is let it knock three times. So if you notice something about a person that's in your field and you have some concern, and again, because I think we have a healthy sense of not wanting to intrude, not wanting to come in and take over, it's often really good. I use that sort of just let it knock three times. Like if something comes up over and over, because if you're just in the grocery store, you know, that may be different in terms of, okay, they've dropped their, you know, shopping bag and you're going to help them, you know, retrieve it. But if there's actually a concern, which I think is what you're talking about, Jamie, that there's something that really is of concern and it's ongoing, it's been going, you know, let it knock a few times within your own being. Let it kind of, you know, check in with yourself. And what is it also that upsets you about this? Because then you're actually in relationship with the person. It upsets me because I saw my father do this. and he never got any help when he was diagnosed with a terminal illness, and I watched him just fade away way too quickly. So you see somebody that maybe has some symptoms or some signs that might be similar, but at least you've checked in with yourself. What is it for me? Or, you know, I'm not comfortable because they're getting more shaky in their life. Like, at least to own your own experience. Once you do that, you can come from that place with connecting with other. You can say, you know, I realize I'm kind of nervous when I watch you walk down the stairs. I'm feeling kind of concerned that you might fall, rather than, you know, looks like you're not doing well with those stairs. You know, and I think we ought to go to the neurologist or at least go to an orthopedist and kind of get that checked out. You know, you bring yourself in to the equation, and then there's a dialogue. And often from that, you know, if you say, well, you know, I'm afraid, or I've got some concerns about the stairs, then it gives them an opportunity to say, you know what, it is getting harder for me, because you've already named and kind of given some room for, you know, the actual experience, right, rather than just the task or just the quote-unquote problem. And I think then you sort of wait and see what comes back. And if you get back, well, I'm fine, I've done this for 30 years, you go, well, okay, it just looks to me, you know, like it's going a little differently. And I think also, like anything, don't expect immediate results. You know, you've planted that seed, you've voiced your concern. On some level, for that moment, you let go of the outcome. Because if it's really a concern, again, them walking down the stairs, or for older adults who want to age in place, you know, one of the biggest things you do right away is you take up all the throw rugs. You take up all the scatter rugs, because they're the biggest sign or, you know, reason that people get off balance and trip and fall and hurt themselves. You know, I'd say check in with your own experience, see what's bothering you about it, and also share that dilemma with them.
What the picture you were painting, Judith, is one where there's dignity. You know, you're treating this person with dignity and not infantilizing them, because I think that's what we need to become aware of is as we age, or as our elders are aging, there's this power differential that starts to shift. You know, your parents are now dependent on you. And so how do you interact with them? How do you speak with them? How do you treat them in a way is, you know, still honoring their integrity and their dignity? So just want to add that.
So it's also very important to honor their need for independence. Recognize that most of us don't want to give that up easily. Some words that seem to resonate are, how can I support you in your independence? How can I get you the help you need so that you can be independent as long as you can? So it kind of turns it upside down for them, rather than you're taking away something. How can I support you in your independence?
Hi, Prescott. You had talked a little bit about contemplative care or hospice care, and I guess I'd like a little more information about that. You said it would be Medicare-based, and I'm wondering whether it would accept Medicaid. Would you be able to deal with people with dementia in different stages?
I mentioned Medicare and Medicaid. This new contemplative care hospice will, of course, you know, meet the guidelines of both of those organizations. But the idea of the contemplative care hospice is to go well beyond kind of the basic requirements. And for quite a while, hospice has been kind of hemmed in by those guidelines. So the idea of the contemplative care hospice is to really expand the realm of care that has been traditional foremost hospices. Yes, that will be a part of it, but it will also, Medicare and Medicaid will apply to the contemplative care hospice, but it will go well beyond that. And it will be able to do that because we're going to be setting up a hybrid organization, which will be both nonprofit and for-profit hybrid together.
You basically need to be within 6 months of death or so. And so dementia can be a part of a bigger, more serious diagnosis, but not coverable by those funds.
Working together, we can make a change. Working together, we can help better things.
Don't forget, you are welcome to be an audience member at the Restoring the Soul Forum. The audio tapes of past and present forums may also be heard on Restoring the Soul's website, www.restoringthesoul.org, or you may contact us at 720 304-6446.